Hello and welcome back to the Mindful World Summit. I'm Dr. Stacy, and I'm thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Jay Kumar. Dr. Jay is a thought leader and public speaker. He counsels organizations and businesses on harnessing the art and science of happiness for both short and long-term success. Dr. Jay is a respected university professor who stays at the forefront of brain research and is also the founder of the Applied Brain Science Research Institute. He's here today to talk to us about the science of having a happy brain. Dr. Jay, welcome to the summit.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stacy, and thank you to everyone who is being a part of this wonderful summit.
Yes, and we are so excited for you to be here and so thankful that people are tuning in, because this is really information that people want and need. And as someone who is at the heart of this brain research understands it, you have this overview of our health and the data, the research that is informing your perspective. So we're really thankful for you being here and to give us that bird's eye view. I'm wondering, from that perspective, you know, from what you can tell, from what we know so far, what is the most dangerous health crisis that our generation is facing now?
Well, that's a really important and wonderful question to start off asking, because if I can just contextualize for 30 seconds how I got to this answer. I've been teaching at my university, at Chapman University, one of the most popular courses, the happiness course. Who doesn't want to be happy, right? But it's from that course, which I've been doing for the past 7 years, where this and my research, the science of a happy brain, really stems from. And in my research and in this, for this topic today, it really amazed me as I was doing the research how we are examining the brain and looking at the brain in a way that is not congruent with how evolution allowed the brain to evolve. And so let me kind of say this to you, and this will be the answer I'm going to give to you. We've always looked at the brain as a rational organ, a cognitive organ, an emotional organ, but now something very new is emerging in brain science research, which is really the forefront of what I do, and that is looking at the brain as a social organ, looking specifically how the brain evolved for community, for connection, for cohesion, collaboration. And so in the context of evolution, when you look at this idea of the brain being a social organ, the biggest crisis of our generation is what I call the illness of isolation.
Okay.
And when I say the illness of isolation, it means that we are disconnected in an overconnected world. We are so overconnected digitally. We are so overconnected in terms of our communication online. But what's really lacking is the physical impact, the primal wiring of brain evolved in such a way to look at socialization as a survival strategy. If I may, I'm going to give an example to your listeners on how this evolved. So imagine, just picture yourself if you can, 10,000 years ago, you're a cave person walking around in the ancient savannas of Earth. It's a pretty scary time if you're if you're an ancient cave person 10,000 years ago. Life was pretty, life was a struggle, you can probably imagine. So imagine you're all by yourself. You haven't eaten for about 3 days. You're thirsty. You're tired. It's cold, and to make it even worse, the sound of hungry predators are in the distance and growing louder. That's that's a pretty stressful situation to be in, right?
Yeah.
So imagine if you had one other able-bodied person with you, would your chances for survival increase? Yes. Imagine if you had 5, 10, 50. Able-bodied people who were looking out for your safety and you were looking out for their safety. This is how the human brain evolved to recognize that pro-social behavior, so socialization, the need for collaboration, compassion, the need for cooperation, and the need for community, all stemmed out of an evolutionary tactic for survival. And so the idea of tribe, this idea of tribe, you know, it's a loaded word because it does have negative aspects to it, which we'll maybe talk about today as well. But when I talk about tribe, I talk about the positive aspects of how we're wired for community. We're wired for connection. And so I have this equation that I always tell to my happiness course, my students of the happiness course, which I also lecture about. Attachment to tribe equals life. Abandonment from tribe equals death. That was a literal, I'm talking literally, that was the equation for survival 10,000 years ago, which that equation, if you will, is still wired into everyone's brain today. Mm-hmm. And those human beings who realize or recognize that cooperation and socialization were a strategy for survival, they pass that functional behavioral strategy into the gene pool to everyone on the planet today. Your brain, my brain, everyone on this planet today has the genetic and the neurobiological hardwirings for socialization. Mm-hmm. And so we're finding in my research that there are multiple systems in the human brain that evolved to enhance socialization. So when I talk about the illness of isolation, I'm not talking about it just as a cute little phrase. I'm talking literally. This is a danger. What we find in the research that, to give a good example, the former U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, in the previous administration, was asked on his departure, what is the greatest health crisis of our generation? And he said, it's loneliness.
It's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I kind of phrase it the illness of isolation. Yeah. And the same idea applies in that we have become, our society has advanced in leaps and bounds technologically. And there's no denying that we need technology. In fact, we're doing this, you know, through being technology, right? Yeah. And the people listening to us right now are doing through technology. So those are fine. Those are amazing positive aspects of technology. The problem comes when technology and the use of the internet overcomes or surpasses the basic biological drives we have for in-person connection. And it's so to answer this question in a very long about way, this for me is the greatest, not only health crisis, this is what I call diminishes our ability for a happy brain, is the inability to connect in real time versus, you know, on virtual time or FaceTime. The inability to find deep, meaningful connections with our neighbors, with our community, with just our family. And I'm sure your listeners or your viewers are aware of this. You go to any restaurant today, and it's ridiculous. You'll have a party of like five or six people at a table, and yes, I'll be talking, but everyone has their cell phones out. So it's a huge problem that we have here today. And so, you know, what I really feel is that if going against our ancient primal wiring of the brain, that social brain. So to add on to that equation I said earlier, I said, you know, attachment to tribe equals life. The more people you have in your tribe, your chances for survival and life increase. So attachment to tribe equals life. Abandonment from tribe equals death. Let's add one more piece in that equation. Attachment to tribe equals life equals happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Abandonment from tribe equals death equals despair.
Right. Yeah.
So you can kind of see this in a very interesting way. It all begins to align. There's like a merging of different disciplines coming together in what I do, not just in neuroscience research. I look at our happiness through a biological, psychological, social, and spiritual model. and to see how we can begin to cultivate a happy brain, taking the best from brain science research, but also taking the best from spirituality and profound religious traditions as well.
Amazing. And I can underscore everything you just said. What's interesting is that this idea of loneliness, not necessarily being about the number of people, but mm-hmm. the depth of connection, right?
Right. And, you know, as a psychologist, you're aware, when we talk about loneliness, we're really talking about loneliness as a psychological and an emotional state. Mm-hmm. So it's different from isolation. Isolation is a physical state. Mm-hmm. Whereas loneliness is a psycho-emotional state. So as you stated clearly, Dr. Casey, you can be surrounded by hundreds of people if you're living in an urban center, which many people do these days, mm-hmm. you can be surrounded by hundreds of people but still experience profound and deep loneliness. Mm-hmm. And here is something I really want your listeners and your viewers to be aware of. As I mentioned earlier, we're discovering there are multiple systems, what I call default mechanisms in the brain, that trigger us when we experience isolation and loneliness. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to share one with your viewers, if I may.
Yes, please.
And so they did a study at UCLA, not too far from where I teach. I teach in Southern California. And a study was done in the early 2000s where, without going into too much detail, they put people into these fMRI machines where they could measure brain activity in real time. This is the wonder of modern technology. We can actually look and peer into the human brain in real time at this given moment, which is fantastic. But this one study revealed that they triggered a situation where the person in the fMRI machine experienced what we call social pain. So imagine social pain. You're being taunted by someone at school. Mm-hmm. You were dumped by your partner from 7 years unexpectedly. You got fired mm-hmm. from your job with no reason whatsoever. Something happens to you in your brain we call social pain. But mm-hmm. here is the most amazing part, which reinforces why the brain evolved as a social organ. This study found that the same region of your brain that registers physical pain, so imagine you break a bone or you get hit on the head by accident, there's a part of your brain, I don't want to go too much into neuroanatomy, but your viewers will trust me on this, there's the same region of your brain that fires and lights up when you experience physical pain. But what they found, social pain also registers in overlapping regions of that brain region. Mm-hmm. And the same thing when you regulate pain, your body has an autonomic regulatory system mm-hmm. for dealing with pain, physical pain. Your opioid system switches on. And so opioids get released to dampen physical pain when that happens. What they found, the same region of your brain that regulates physical pain also regulates social pain. What mm-hmm. does this mean? Mm-hmm. Your brain, my brain, everyone's brain out there is incapable of distinguishing physical pain from social pain.
That is so fascinating. But it makes sense when we think about this model of survival.
So when you think about this in the context of evolution and survival, when you feel loneliness, which is social pain as well, when you feel isolated, your brain shoots a signal that says, this is not a survival strategy. Something is dysregulating our ability for survival here. And in order to compensate for that, as you know, any organism, whether it's an amoeba or a human being or even a society or a group, will go to any means to mitigate or to lessen pain. And so in the absence of community, in the absence of what I call authentic tribe, mm-hmm. your brain has to find other means to cope with that pain. And what we find, unfortunately, this tends to be the source of many addictions.
Yeah.
This tends to be the source of many behavioral disorders, if you will, that can have negative consequences on your longevity, your sense of resilience, your sense of purpose and meaning. And this is not, I'm saying that this is the, someone, I think Gabor, Dr. Gabor Mate said this very well. Mm-hmm. The opposite of addiction is connection.
Yes, absolutely. And you know what, as I'm listening to you, because in most of my career, I work with people with chronic pain. So people mm-hmm. who were taken out of their regular life because of an accident, and their body, based on whatever we can see on the, you know, on the x-ray, or just understanding of how the body heals, it looks like it's healed. Like there's no injury, but the pain signal continues. And what's happening in my brain as I listen to you, because we also use the biopsychosocial spiritual model.
Yes.
Is that there is a social connection from the tribe, mm-hmm. no longer part of the regular part of life. And that in itself, I'm like, would that create also add to the physical pain? What you're implying is that, like, there's a lot of things going on at once, but could that disconnection from life, from things that make things meaningful, actually add to the pain signal staying for a long time?
Yes, it would add to the pain signal, is the pain receptors in the brain. It yeah. might not register as actual physical pain. So to give you an example, we okay. know that, you know, breaking a toe is a very strong, sharp
sure.
pain signal to your brain. So breaking a bone versus having broken bones versus broken bonds, if you will, as I like yeah. to say, broken bones versus broken bonds, the same part of your brain registers that dysregulation, that pain. But of course, the pain from a broken bone is going to be perceived or experienced much differently than the pain from not having strong social connections to a community.
Sure.
But what we're saying here, I think Dr. Stacy, you and I are both advocating, is that your brain has a hard time distinguishing, wait a minute, is this physical pain? Is this social pain? Is this mm-hmm. emotional pain? What's going on here? Because it's all the same. Pain's all the same to your brain, is how I like to say it.
Yeah.
And so this is why I getting back to your first question, which is so poignant, this is to me the reason why I believe and why I advocate the greatest health crisis of our time is the illness of isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that we're doing in our culture and our society tends to promote this sense of isolation. And to give you your viewers two examples, and you probably are aware of this from your practice as well, I find that two corollary factors or two corollary causes, if you will, that fuel the illness of isolation. One is called isolationism. This idea is that, you know, we tend to isolate when we go. Our society prioritizes or sometimes actually says, you know, just suck it up and just tough it up. Do it on your own.
Yeah.
And there sometimes can be also what I call psychological individualism. This idea is that you've got to just do it on your own. Don't rely on anyone else to help you out. Mm-hmm. And so there are these two competing narratives in our society today, which I think are playing a tug of war with our health and happiness and our happy brain. One is the narrative of nature, which says you are driven for connection, you're driven for community, you're driven to actually, you're driven to feel a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
You're driven neurobiologically and evolutionarily to connect. But we have a competing narrative in our society today, which is which says, no, if you got to make it in the world, you got to do it on your own. You don't count on anyone else. Or even worse, when you experience pain, don't seek out help.
Yes. Yeah.
And this is
a big problem.
It's a huge problem. There's a stigma.
Mm-hmm.
As you probably are aware of, Dr. Stacy, when we are maybe looked down upon for seeking out help, more so psychological, emotional, social support.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much physical. You know, if you have a broken bone, go to a doctor, right? But if you have broken bonds or you're feeling a sense of isolation, it can be very difficult for many people to actually take that step mm-hmm. and seek out support. And yeah. so they either they self-regulate with habits that might not be so healthy.
Right. And I mean, this is where it gets really interesting again with my background is that the injury or the illness can become that vehicle. It has a job to do. It plays a role in bringing people towards, right? And so that becomes the thing that gets the help, that gets the attention, that gets that feeling of love or connection. And so this whole work is about let's separate all of this stuff so we can actually build a skill set and understand. And what's interesting, I'm interested in your perspective as someone who counsels organizations and businesses around happiness, but also success, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you delve into the area of performance, we recognize like that superstar athlete that got that gold medal has an entire team around them.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yes,
like
yes.
That you see that person on the podium taking the glory, but there's a whole lot that went into supporting that athlete.
Oh, yeah. 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 And that really is the case. You know, again, it goes back to this competing narrative that we have mm-hmm. that I'm a self-made person. I got successful. Like for every, you know, for all the Bill Gates and for all the Oprah Winfreys out there, mm-hmm. you know, which we might admire, they had a whole team making this yes. happen. They had people supporting them the entire way. Of course, their ideas might have been their own, but you know, they had a tribe. They had a whole cadre of people who were supporting them and making sure they got to where they were. Mm-hmm. And so this is why, you know, I think it's very important for our viewers to understand, as I say, to socialize is to survive, to thrive is to thrive.
Okay. And when you're talking about tribe, you're talking about these close bonds of people in your life that are just got your back and you got theirs. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I do mean that. And I do want to emphasize and clarify because I do know the word tribe has a very negative connotation.
Yeah.
There are negative aspects towards tribe, which we can talk about briefly. But when I say tribe, I'm talking more about who are the 3 to 5 people in your life who you know will just be at your side in times of dire emergency or stress, mm-hmm. you know? And for many people, and this is true today, they found that in 2018 versus in 1978, so you're talking maybe just a 40-year time span, people have, when they poll people, how many close relations or how many close people do you have in your life who you can turn to in times of strife or struggle. In 1978, it was about 4 to 5. Now it's about 1 or 2.
Right. Okay.
You know, so, and this may not come as a surprise. It's even less for men than women. Men,
sure.
for various reasons, it's too complicated to get into in our discussion today, mm-hmm. but men, whether it's biological or if it's sociological or mm-hmm. both, we don't really mm-hmm. know, but men tend to isolate and disconnect more so than women.
Absolutely. Yes. and you know, I have to think, I mean, I just have to go to the movie theater to see that it takes to be a man, which comes to your point, right? We don't mm-hmm. allow a lot of space to be human among men, and there's that needs to change. Absolutely.
It does.
So tell me, you've studied this, you are teaching, and how, you know, this sounds like people are gravitating towards social media. It's playing on this idea of finding that tribe. Tell me your perspective on this, because I mean, certainly it plays on that biology, it sounds mm-hmm. like.
Yeah.
But what is the reality of these habits, tools, however you want to talk about it, social media? How is that working?
Yeah, yes. That's a whole conversation, but I'm going to kind of try and distill it into maybe, you know, a few key points, I think, for our viewers today. You know, the one thing I like to say, you know, we can't get on social media. It's not going anywhere in our lifetime. It's going to get even more ubiquitous and more common in our daily habits. But the point I want to make is this. Imagine, you know, let's just say, you know, for most people who have children, you know, if you're a parent, you want to make sure your child is well fed. You don't want to be giving your child junk food and have that be his or her source of sustenance. So in the same way, we look at the analogy like junk food versus having three solid square meals a day to nourish your body. I think of social media as junk food for the brain. It nourishes, it might satiate the brain temporarily, as my Twinkies or little cookies might do or candy might do. But it's not the same as nourishing your body with like vegetables and healthy grains and whole natural three meals a day that we need versus just kind of having these like junk food snacks. So so I the analogy I use is social media can be great as a snack. You know, when you want to see what's going on with your friends in Australia or what's going on with your cousins, your kids, you know, that's great, but don't confuse social media as the nourishment for your brain, that real in-person interactions allow.
So
that's the analogy I use. Social media is the junk food. Social media is the junk food for the body, for the brain, as junk food is for the body, versus real in-person interactions are the three square meals you need for a nourished brain, and et cetera. So that's it right there. Can't live your entire life on junk food. So don't think you live your entire life nourishing your happy brain on social media.
Yes, exactly. It is just a snack. It's just a snack. We need really good nourishment. So how do we nourish our brains best? You talk about really more than we have to think about it in a very rich and organic way. And you have the four C's that you talked about. Can you tell us a bit about this?
I do. Thanks, Dr. Stace, for bringing that up. I talk about the science of a happy brain in the context of promoting what I call the four C's. And those C's are comfort, contribution, connection, and compassion. So I'll repeat those. Comfort, contribution, connection, and compassion. So comfort can mean on a very biological level. I talk about comfort being, you know, making sure you get enough sleep, making sure you get enough rest, you get good food, but also taking comfort with your tribe, if you will, in moments of strife. Making sure that you reach out to people in times of challenges and you don't isolate. Contribution, what I call, you know, the psychological aspect of a happy brain. So contribution, knowing that what you're doing brings you value and meaning and brings you a sense of purpose in what you do. And it doesn't matter what it is that you're doing for a career or profession, but it's something that needs to bring you a sense of purpose and meaning. I do a lot of counseling work and consulting work for CEOs and executives who are very well positioned and successful in their career, but what they feel is lacking in their life after they reach that pinnacle of their career is what now brings me meaning. I'll give you a quick example. I once led a retreat for 12 very successful businessmen in Hong Kong. The net worth in that room, in that retreat for 12 people, was probably about $4 billion.
Wow.
But all they wanted to do was like, Dr. J, I just want to know what's my purpose in life, what makes me happy.
Isn't that interesting?
You know, and so contribution, waking up in the day, if you can wake up every morning and say, you know what, I can't wait to go to work. I can't wait to have my day start because I feel that I'm making a difference in the world. It doesn't mean you have to be the next Nelson Mandela, you know, or next Rosa Parks, you know. No, it just means get up in the morning, and it could be to know that my contribution is making sure my kids or my children are happy and well-adjusted. For me, being a professor, it's like knowing I'm making contribution to the future generation of our society. So that's one. The second C, psychological, which is contribution.
Yes.
The third being connection, which we've talked about for quite a bit right now, is making sure every day you have one in-person interaction with someone. You know, if you can, mm-hmm. not, and that doesn't mean social media. It means like having a real
time conversation.
And that can mean on the phone as well. It can mean, but it can mean you're actually talking to someone. What they found is that when you actually have a conversation with someone, like you and I are having, or most people have, the percentage of time people talk about themselves is 30 to 40%. Okay. Versus when you are on social media, just posting something, it's you're talking more about yourself about 80% of the time. Mm-hmm. You're not really hearing what other people have to say. You're just telling the world about yourself. Mm-hmm. So connecting to other people is what I call the social aspect of the happy brain. And the fourth, which I find to be very important, is compassion. And this is one, if I could say, the one of the four C's, connection is certainly, I think, one of the ones that we need to focus on, but I think compassion is as well. I feel that what's happening in our society, at least I'm here in the United States, is that there has been a decline in empathy and compassion.
Yes.
For people who think differently, who pray differently, who love differently, who look differently, who whatever you want to use is the idea. And that's, I think, this the spiritual aspect of a happy brain. And so to maybe recap these four C's, the biological happiness is comfort.
Yes.
Psychological happiness is contribution. Social happiness is connection. And spiritual happiness is compassion. And learning to cultivate these four aspects, you know, whether they're simple tasks, like for comfort, just doing one thing for your body or your brain, if you will, meditation. It can be eating healthy foods. It can be, again, turning to people in times of trouble and crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Contribution, knowing that what you're doing makes a difference in the world. Even if your job or your career doesn't maybe give you that, do volunteer work. Do something that, you know, so do something with your community. There are so many people and there are so many organizations out there who can use your time. It can be something simple for me. What I do sometimes, I love to go live in Southern California. I go swimming in the ocean. I do lap swims in the ocean. That's my favorite thing to do when the weather permits. But one thing I do is on every day when I do this, I pick up 3 pieces of trash on the beach.
There you go.
That's contribution right there.
Yes.
You're doing something. It's such a little thing, but it helps.
Yes.
And the social has connection. Knowing you have real, live, interactive, physical connections with people. Mm-hmm. And the last being spiritual happiness is compassion. Learning to put yourself in other people's shoes. Learning to maybe see where are people coming from in terms of why they behave that way. And the problem we have today is that we focus more on comparison, what makes us different. Comparison focuses on what makes us different. Compassion focuses on what makes us similar.
Yes. And I love that model. And they're all connected and build on each other, right?
They
disconnected and you see how it wears away at the fabric. Like just that point that you made about the social media, the difference between in-person listening, right? Mm-hmm. Like building our empathy muscle versus just talking.
Yeah.
And
just spouting all your thoughts and rants on social media.
Yeah. And so the more, if you're spending a lot of our social time just putting stuff out versus really listening, and we're feeling disconnected and we're not building that part of our brain that is creating connection, which is required for it's connected, all, right?
Yes. And so these four C's, when I talk about comfort, contribution, connection, compassion, they all go back to evolutionary biology and the idea that the human brain evolved for that sense of community. And it all goes back to this idea of tribe and community. When you have community, all those four C's are there.
Mm-hmm.
When you have tribe, all those four C's are organically present in your life.
So, you know, this is in terms of building resiliency as parents, thinking about, excuse me, I'm just going to cough. And we're back. And when we think about the things that are making our children resilient or wearing away on that, it helps with the decision making, but it also helps us take stock of ourselves and how are we living in a way that's consistent with these four C's and building the bonds of family, which is for many people they're a micro tribe, or if we're not don't have families of our own, you know, what is the family we build from the people we choose to have in our lives, and how do we nurture those relationships?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and tribe doesn't have to be biological, as you stated very well. Mm-hmm. Your tribe doesn't have to be biological family. You know, it can be a support group that you belong to.
Yeah.
I know many people who are in groups like AA, where that's their tribe. I know people who are single moms, who have other single moms who get together once a week and just support each other. Or there's a network of single moms who just like, you know, if you need anything, I'm here. And so this idea is that it doesn't necessarily have to be that your tribe is blood relative.
Right.
It's the people who care about you, the people who want you to thrive, the people who care about your welfare and happiness, and you care about theirs as well.
Right.
And I find that there's so much we can talk about in the course of this conversation. and the good thing is, you know, there's more of my research for and other people who are on this platform have more outside of this this interview over here. Mm-hmm. But the point being is that this is just the tip of the iceberg. You know, I'm just trying to give to your viewers and to our audience here the primacy of why we are experiencing so much dysfunction in our world. And I don't want to be negative, I want to end on the positive, but you can't heal the patient unless you know what the underlying
disease or
your illness is. And so for society, if we look at society as the patient, or as kind of that's my metaphor I'm using, what really got me onto this whole track of looking at brain science and behavioral health in the context of happiness is that so many of us in the past 15 years, there has been a spike in suicide, addiction, mm-hmm. depression, anxiety disorders, PTSD, violence. They're on the increase. And so what I try to maybe advocate is that maybe what we are missing is we're failing to see how these are all just what you might call symptoms of a deeper illness, which I call the illness of isolation. And the reason why I say that with strong belief is that it's going against what evolution primed us for, to be social beings. You know, the joke I make in my happiness course, we're not Homo sapiens, we're Homo socialis. We're social humans. You know, we're not Homo sapiens is the biological term that we, our species, you know, is called in biology. But I say we're really Homo socialis. We're social creatures. We're social humans, and we're driven for the need to feel value, belonging, and engagement. And that's missing in our world today. People don't feel a sense of belonging anymore. Mm-hmm. People are not feeling a sense of what my value is worth in the world. We measure our wealth by money and not by how much value we bring into the world.
Yes.
You know, the sense of feeling that we, that success and that, you know, happiness or health is going to be found in the pursuit of money or a bigger home, or a six-figure salary, or a title at the end of our name. There's nothing inherently wrong with any of those pursuits, but if those are the vehicles that you believe are going to achieve happiness, that becomes the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, and the wrong model, absolutely.
The wrong model. And so we know this from witnessing aspects of the news. Where I live in California, there's been horrific wildfires. And we know in times of crisis, whether it's 9/11, the hurricanes that have devastated the Southwest and the South and the Southeast in the past couple of years, the forest fires in California, even the horrific things we've seen, like public shootings taking place. As horrific as those tragedies are, the one common theme that's pervasive in all of those tragedies is that we come together and help each other in times of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of our how we vote or how we act or how we love or how we pray or how we look, it's an instinctive drive we have to come to the aid of others in suffering.
Yeah.
And so my hope, and this is something, you know, to maybe one way to end this conversation, is one thing that I really hope we all can do is to act upon those basic primal instincts for altruism, for compassion, for empathy, not just in times of crisis, but all the time.
Right.
And that's the biggest challenge, but also the biggest solution that's going to help shift so many of the issues we face today in our world.
Dr. J, I could not have said that any better myself. That is so powerful. And I have to say that this is why we're here and this is why we're doing this. You totally summed up the whole motivation of this summit. and my own insight from a few years ago, when I hear those horrible messages on the news, I think my first thought is there's somebody who is really disconnected. And if we all took that responsibility, but taking the knowledge of something, someone like yourself that brings the science to it, we're all responsible in a way in creating the kind of world we want to live in.
I know.
And what you're talking about is the resiliency that also the good news that shows up is that when push comes to shove, people show up for each other.
Yeah, I think the fabric of the human species is resiliency. Our DNA is wired for resiliency. And you know, one thing, if there's an empowering message I can give to all the viewers out there, it's this: never be afraid to let your light shine forth fully and brightly, because the world would be a much dimmer place without you in it. So that really is it. Let your light shine, because that one person who needs it, you know, needs your light. And it could be smiling to the homeless person, saying, you know, I acknowledge you, I see you. It could mean, you know, just making sure that your next door neighbor is okay. I have an elderly neighbor who lives next to me, and I make sure that she's okay once a week. Mm-hmm. I check in on her. So there are these little things we can do that can make the world a better place. And as I say, happy brains make happy people. Happy people make a happy world. So it all starts with you. Let's get your brain happy. The science of a happy brain falls upon you. Happy brains, happy people, happy world.
Dr. J, this has been amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you
so much for all your work, what you're doing in the world, and for adding to so amazingly to this summit. This has been such a great conversation. Tell us, if people want to understand your work and what you're doing, the latest research, what's the best way for them to connect with your teacher?
Yes, thank you. So I have an institute called the Applied Brain Science Research Institute. The acronym is ABSRI. So www.absri.com.
Excellent. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more hits to that website where people are going to be intrigued to want to learn more. Dr. J. Kumar, thank you so much for, again, everything you're doing and your contribution here. It really is about creating this more mindful world, in deep gratitude.
Very grateful to be part of this. Thank you so much for the opportunity, Dr. Stacey.
Take care.